Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Aparuta de sangamata satavara ye sodavanta bamunchantu satang. Now this is the full moon night of January 2005. We've all renewed our sila commitment, and this is the vehicle, earthly vehicle that we're using for boundaries, commitments to restraint in regards to action and speech. Now, you request, when you become a bhikkhu, you have to request three times to be accepted, and then train under the Vinaya, so forth. The lay people have to ask for the eight precepts. So this conveys how sila is regarded, or morality, as something we request, not something imposed on us. So it's a voluntary thing. It's not to intimidate or to attach to the convention, but to see the value of restraint in order to be mindful. If we don't know our boundaries in regards to action and speech, then we tend to, cause a lot of more confusion to ourselves and others. So if we just follow impulses and desires, forces of habit, as we go along, then without any kind of conventional reflection on any limitation on behavior, then it's hard to get any perspective. So say in the samana life, the foundation is the sila. And this is on the conventional level of living in a human form, living in a community in which we have to live together as samanas here, and the commitments we have, we renew every fortnight, just to remind ourselves of what we are doing, what's the purpose of our life, what is a samana. So it is a time, say, in the worldly life where there aren't any kind of boundaries necessary. Kind of not to just try to not break the law too much or whatever. But on the worldwide level, there's no international agreements on, say, moral conduct, and so you get all kinds of different views and opinions, hardline approaches. Such as fundamentalist attitudes from theistic religions. People seem to, at a time where there's a lot, things seem so uncertain, and there's so much fear in the world, then people revert to kind of more primitive ways of that they remember, where, the kind of reward punishment practices, and the kind of like, is God sending retribution when the tsunami hit the Indian Ocean. And you hear people discussing, is it God's punishment for human sinfulness and the kind of dialogues going on in regards to this from both Muslims and Christians. But this isn't, you know, for in terms of Buddhism, sila is not a matter of reward and punishment. It's an aid to awareness, to awakening. It establishes a kind of a conventional vehicle that we can use, not for identity and not for attachment, but for reflection. So that's the whole point of our life, is to witness and observe the mental state, the experience of here and now as it is, as each individual is experiencing this moment. So we all have our karma. So each one of us is has our own kind of unique character, personality, tendencies, habits, preferences, prejudices, and so forth. So these are reflected in consciousness if we're willing to observe and witness in this moment the way it is. So consciousness then is what we're experiencing right now, and then this is the reality of consciousness. Each one of us is a conscious being. And then what arises in consciousness can be, you know, very different from what is rising in mind right now and what you're thinking or feeling at this moment. In quality or whatever, can be very, very different, very opposite, very, you know, unique, eccentric, conventional, or whatever. But that which is aware, as a conscious being, and a human being, we have the ability to observe, witness, and reflect in this present moment. So we know we can observe what we are feeling, physically, emotionally. So this is what we mean by sati sampatthana, mindfulness, intuitive awareness, apprehension, apperception. An intuitive awareness then is our ability in this moment, everything that is impinging on us, that's happening for us at this moment. So it's not a kind of discriminative thing. It's not like seeking out anything, but just noticing that this moment is like this, the body is like this, the breath is like this, the mental state is like this. Where if we start thinking about it, you know, when we're caught in the thinking process in our intellect, then we start analyzing. We just notice, maybe I don't feel very good tonight, or I feel really good, or, you know, I feel, you know, we can grasp the particular experience, emotional experience we're having, or just out of habit resist or any kind of physical sensations that might be unpleasant, or just get caught in aversion or trying to get rid of them. That's the force of habit, habitual tendencies we've developed in our lives, and these habits tend to take us over. So with meditation, we're actually learning to free ourselves from just the force of habit by awakening and receiving whatever is happening at this moment. So that can be, you know, an intuitive moment includes everything. It's not just looking at one thing and ignoring the rest. So it's to really develop confidence in this intuitive awareness, then it's our ability to open and be receptive in this very moment. It's not trying to concentrate, put our attention on anything in particular, but our ability to stay open to this moment as is. Relax, in other words, a sense of relaxed awareness, receptivity. Because then we're not trying to find anything or get anything from it, but learn to recognize an innate ability, a natural ability we have as human individuals, that is the way of liberation. Because it's only through this way that we can free ourselves from the force of habit that we have, or the suffering that we create. The main point of meditation, then, is to recognize or realize this natural state. When the Buddha was talking about awareness, mindfulness, the path through the deathless, this isn't a created state of mind, and it's not a compounded state that we create through controlling or concentrating. It's a natural state of being that we tend to forget or forgotten all about. So many of us have started out with all kinds of ideas about meditation and Buddhism and concentration and getting states and so forth, so that our emphasis has been on achieving or attaining. Because this is how most of us are conditioned by our societies, and that we're from societies where the education and the attitude of a society is towards progress, attainment, achievement. And so this mindset we bring into Sangha life, thinking we're going to get something from it, so this is where this reflective ability is encouraged. We can think, if I keep all the rules, the moral precepts, and practice hard, then I'll get something for that. I'll be rewarded in some way for doing all the right things. So this is still very much the self-view operating. Like if you're a good boy, you get a reward. If you're a good student, you get praise for that. And so forth. And if you're bad, then you get criticized. But still, the ignorance is a very sense of a self, as being somebody that's got to get something, or get rid of something. How many of you approach meditation idea of getting rid of anger or lust or fear, things like this, getting rid of the defilements in order to become enlightened? These are, you know, average ways of thinking, natural ways of thinking that we sometimes never question, never see through, that we operate from. So that's where I keep emphasizing this sati sampajanya, sati panya, because this is not this is the, when we begin to recognize or realize this natural state of being here and now, it's so normal that we don't notice. When you become a person, a personality, then you're no longer normal. You've become something else. So I remember we used to talk about normal person as some kind of thing that we should try to aim for, to be normal. And somebody who's abnormal is kind of, you don't get too close to them, they're abnormal. But if they're normal, that gives a sense of being safe and acceptable. But when you really contemplate what ignorance, desire, and attachment, what that creates, even what is considered normal in a society is abnormal. In other words, we're living in societies that are abnormal, basically. They're all crazy. Everybody's crazy, actually, until you recognize what is normal, the norm, or the Dhamma. So that during this winter's retreat, the encouragement is to trust yourself during this. This is a special opportunity. Conditions are very, very good here, and very the support, the situation, the time, the place, and the teaching. The emphasis that I'm making is not for attaining, trying to get rid of your defilements or attain concentrated states, but to awaken and trust in your, it's a natural ability, it's not a fantastic feat that only very advanced kind of human beings could ever hope to achieve. That is another abnormal view. When I talk about sati sampajanya, these are the Pali words, and this is the very essence of the Buddha's teaching. Mindfulness, awareness, awakeness. The very word Buddha means awake. It means human being who's awake. And this awakenness is a real awakenness, not just a kind of, because your eyes are open and you're conscious, but you can still be lost in the realm of your own thoughts and views and emotional habits, and you think you're awake. But in terms of Bhutto or Buddha, this awakenness is this sati sampajanya. It's the ability that each one of us has in this human form to reflect, to observe. So, just like right now, observing the way it is. And of course, one starts with the body or the breath, that which is quite obvious and at this moment, the breathing, anapanasati, or the posture of the four postures, sitting, standing, walking, lying down. But it's not don't make it into any kind of exercise or create it into anything, but just observe the breath, inhalations like this, exhalations like this. That which is aware of an inhalation. Oh. Who is it, or what is it that's aware? When you're inhaling and exhaling, or sitting, so it's not a matter of analyzing why you're breathing or whether you're breathing in the right way or the wrong way or whatever, but because this isn't to make value judgments about what's happening right now, but observing. So the way it is, Pali da-da-da, they have this word da-da-da, means the way it is, as-isness, suchness, which is, using this word, is not a definition. It's not a judgment of anything. It's just a way of thinking that might help you to observe. Remind you to be the observer. Rather than be somebody who's trying to meditate. So the breath, the body, be the putto. The Bhutto that sees what kind of mental state, you emotionally right now, what's the quality of your emotional state, as you feel happy, sad, full of faith and inspiration, or full of doubt and despair, or whatever, just what is it that can observe? If you're feeling doubtful and uncertain, what is it that observes this? So by questioning like this, say, what is it, or who is it, or what is it? What can observe this feeling of dis-ease, or anger, or tension, or whatever you're experiencing? So this is a way of reflecting, of awakening to the way it is, but it's not a judgment. So whatever way you're feeling is not, the point is not to put some kind of value judgment on it, but just recognize all that's necessary is receiving it, letting it be what it is, rather than being caught in the habits of trying to. If we're in a bad mood, and then we observe this, then we don't, even bad mood is too much. It is what it is. And I call it a bad mood, then that's making it more than what it is. But this is just a way of speaking. If one is in a kind of grumpy mood, what is it that knows that this mood is this way? Then the habit tendency might be to try to get rid of it. If you're trying to suppress it, get rid of something you don't like, that's maybe your habit tendency. If you feel like this, you automatically kind of impulsively try to avoid it, distract yourself, or you just follow it. You just start feeling grumpy and critical, and then you just, everyone you see, you find something wrong with, and you just indulge in your critical faculties. Because when I'm in a bad mood, grumpy mood, everything I see, there's something wrong with it. Even if it's a sunny day, grumpy, it's too sunny, or because that grasping the grumpy mood as some kind of out of habit, then everything is tinged by that, so that's why it distorts the present moment, and you you see, you experience life through this distortion. But if you trust yourself to awaken to it, it is what it is. Receive it. Let it be what it is. Which is neither indulging in it or trying to get rid of it, but being patient, accepting, receptive. And moods of any sort, or they arise, they cease, they are very impermanent. And you begin to know how to let go, how to release yourself, how to free yourself from emotional habits and fears and desires that cause you so much unhappiness in your life. Now the critical mind is, that's what we're, our education, isn't it? What modern education about is all about knowing what is the best and the worst and what should and shouldn't be and which is bigger and smaller and so forth. So this is a function that we have. Intellectual abilities to compare, to analyze, and there's nothing wrong with this. I'm not criticizing our critical faculty. I was trying to point to it and to begin to look at it for what it is, rather than be caught into it, lost into it, identified with it, believing it. And so much of our discontentment, in the holy life, isn't it? Even in places like this or any monastery that I've ever lived in, if I let my critical faculty take over, then there's always something wrong, something shouldn't be. The mind will always seek and kind of grasp the things I don't like or don't want. Or it might go the other way. I refuse to notice anything like that and just try to convince myself this is the best monastery in the whole world and our teacher is the best teacher and our form of Buddhism is the best and Buddhism is the best. And then we try to suppress any negative feeling by grasping these kind of affirmations of our, we have the best. But that also is, suffering. Just desperately trying to affirm everything is based on ignorance, not understanding, so inevitably it leads to, you can only sustain it for a while and then it falls apart. So, but with awareness, then the spectrum of positive and negative, good and bad, right and wrong, is received in the same moment. It's with no preferences, but it certainly knows things as they are. It's discerning. It's wisdom, paññā. And the discerning ability in paññā then is in terms of meditation, like vipassana is development of the paññā faculty. Insight into the way things are, all conditions are impermanent. So this isn't an intellectual exercise by just projecting the ideal of impermanence onto everything you see, hear, smell, taste, touch, and think. Sometimes we do that. We say, the Buddha said all conditioned phenomena is impermanent. So then we just say, everything, this temple is impermanent, the weather is impermanent, the seasons are impermanent, everything is impermanent. The Paithankaranija, but actually what we're doing is we're grasping the teaching, all conditions are impermanent, and then we project that onto experience. But that's not sati sampajanya. And that's not liberating, just to convince yourself everything is impermanent. What this is pointing to is observing impermanence, just like just one inhalation. Just something is obviously impermanent is an inhalation. But it's not to say an inhalation is impermanent, but to really be with the impermanence of it from its beginning to its ending. So you're learning to sustain your attention, putting your attention, witnessing something very obvious, but you're not trying to convince yourself it's impermanent, because you're observing impermanence. You don't have to say it or believe it. It is, this is the way it is. Impermanent is like this, anicca. I also observed, you know, in observing my breath, how easy it is to concentrate on an inhalation and how easy it is to wander on the exhalation. I don't know about you, but I used to see this. I had no problems concentrating fully on an inhalation. Then I noticed the exhalation, my mind tends to wander. Start thinking about something. So just observing, you know, some things, you know, like the rising state, isn't it? When we're interested, when we're fascinated, when we have faith and so forth, it's just the sense of inspiration or inhalation. That's a kind of a rising side that somehow interests us, or it's easy to be with it, and then in its decaying state, we tend to look for something else. Now, this is just from my own reflections, and don't think that you have to see things like I do, just sharing what I've learned just from watching my breath. Or the body. You know, the four postures. At first, when they said, be aware of the body and that of the posture, I found that quite difficult, because it had been a way of experiencing a physical body I'd never even thought of. I'd use my body for exercises, sports, fitness training, all kinds of things, you know, vanity and so forth, and seen it in all these different ways. But just to be aware of the body as it is, as an experience right now, sitting, is like this. And then my mind would think, well, what is it? You know, I don't feel anything special, just, you know. Should I be experiencing something? You know, what am I supposed to be experiencing if I'm just sitting, standing, walking, lying down? Because it's kind of a totally new way of experiencing one's own body, as far as I was concerned. And suddenly the penny dropped. Click. Yeah, it's just the way it is, sitting. The body sitting. And I began to just notice the feeling of pressure or the body, and, you know, as I opened to the reality of sitting, then it, I began to notice the sensations and so forth that were quite obvious, but ignored when I was trying to think I should be experiencing something, when I already had in mind or some doubt or idea that I should, what am I supposed to be experiencing if I'm sitting? So intuitive awareness embraces the whole body, the breath, the mood, sensory impingement, whatever, all in the same moment. You know, it's a holistic, as they say, modern New Age jargon, holistic reality or oneness. And then you talk about experience of oneness. When you start thinking, you automatically divide things up, don't you? Thought is a divisive ability we have. It divides. And we're trained to think, and we're identified with our thoughts and our memories. But if you really notice what thinking does, its function is to divide, you know, you and me. That's already operating from thought. I'm Ajahn Sumedho, you're the Sangha. So, and that on a conventional level is fair enough. But then if one is just caught in that way of relating and experiencing life through division, then, you know, one never, there's always this sense of something inadequate, something to do, you as separate from me, me as I'm the teacher, you're the student, or these kind of roles that we have on a conventional plane begin to be our identities. But if we recognize awareness, it doesn't need thought. Thought is a condition that arises and ceases. Awareness is a natural state. Before we ever started thinking, we were aware. Awareness then embraces thinking. Thinking arises and ceases. And so recognizing this awareness, realizing this natural state. Now I pointed to this, what I call sound of silence, because when you begin to notice this resonating vibratory kind of ring, that you can't get beyond it. I mean, you've kind of reached that center point. Thinking stops, but if there's still consciousness operating, awareness, there's no, there's no sense of a separate self in it, unless I start thinking. But if I'm just trusting, relaxing into this emptiness, this stillness, this silence, then you have that perspective on thought or emotion, mood, that you might, whatever mood you're in right now. So it's the background to everything, where everything arises and ceases. It's the primal ground or the unconditioned, the amata dhamma that you begin to recognize. It's not a creation. It's just to be realized or recognized. It's this way. Doesn't seem like much. In terms of, you know, what you might create out of reading scriptures about the Buddha's enlightenment and the earth, shook and all the different heavenly realms reverberated and that, therefore, you can create a perception of enlightenment as being, some kind of fantastic experience, because the words themselves are extreme in the description. So when we're looking for achieving enlightenment and all that on this level of conditions, and a sense of a person, personal self, it's impossible. You know, sometimes you can, through extreme concentration and control, experience very kind of ecstatic, refined states of consciousness, but you can't sustain them because they depend too much on conditions supporting it. But this awareness doesn't depend on anything. It's not, you know, whether you're in this meditation hall or in London traffic jam or in a mountaintop, in a cave, or on a battlefield. If once you realize this, it's always, you know, it's the way it is. It's a natural state that isn't destroyed by or lost unless we forget. And that's what we forget. We get distracted into conditioned realm again and get wound up into that. So this remembering of this simple remembrance, just like the mantra Bhutto, isn't it? That's what I've used. Or the word silence. Whenever I hear the word silence, I immediately hear the sound of silence. I used to write pages in notebooks, silence, silence, silence. I have them in my kuti, just pages of nothing, but because every time I think the word, the silence is present. And it's interesting, when I came back from Thailand recently, I telephoned my sister who lives in the United States, and she'd been very worried about me because of the tsunami earthquake. I thought I'd left her my schedule, you know, that I thought she knew where I was. We were in Burma at the time where you couldn't send any emails or anything, so I found out she had been quite concerned, phoned Ambayagiri and so forth. So she was very relieved. And so, and anyway, one of the monks from Ambayagiri had gone to see her and given her the book Intuitive Awareness. I was going to give it to her when I go to the States in June, but anyway, she was reading this book, and she was telling me that, and I taught her how to use the sound of silence years ago. And she's a devout Roman Catholic, Third Order Carmelite. She has a special rule that she keeps for householders. And in the past several years, she's had to have a lot of dental work, which has been caused a lot of discomfort, and so a lot of sensation in her, around her teeth and gums, and she couldn't hear the sound of silence anymore. And so she kept trying to find the sound of silence, and she couldn't find it, and she was quite concerned, and then started reading book, Intuitive Awareness, and immediately it was there. That was what she told me anyway. So this is, but it's, you know, like in learning to recognize it, in terms of emotional reaction, like it isn't interesting, it isn't, you know, it's boring. What is more boring than the sound of silence? At least your inhalation, you know, has a beginning and ending. And it does get refined, you know, if you concentrate on your breath, you get very refined. And so it can, you know, it's more kind of interesting. But what I'm pointing to is not just, you know, it's not a matter of being interesting, but recognizing and learning and being able to receive your own emotional reactions to it. So you know, the kind of restlessness it'll bring up. Like for me, and just it's learning to, you know, I found if my reactions to this kind of practice were, I recognized the value and developed it, but the past few years, an incredible restlessness. And this restlessness, as you know, it you know, one wants to do something, you know, feel, you know, the habit of wanting something to do, you know, wanting something to practice, wanting a technique, wanting to have, you know, like so much of my meditation experience in the beginning was doing things, sitting for hours, getting samadhi. You know, there's like I was really on a campaign to conquer Mara and to get something. And so there's always, my meditation was something I was doing, something you do. And quite compulsive, you know, I've got to meditate. I don't have enough time to meditate. There's too many things going on. I need to have more time for meditation and on like that. So there was this idea of I'm someone who has to meditate. But as that illusion fell away, the sense of me being somebody who has to do it, still there's these strong impulses of these restless feelings of wanting something to do. And that takes the patience, but the important thing is the confidence in this. It's not a matter of getting rid of restlessness either, but in learning to receive it, to notice it, to let it be, not to make problems. And that's where Sangha life is so valuable, I find. You know, like being a Buddhist monk, it's a vehicle for living in, because it gives a structure to the day, community to live with. It has a useful function in the society. You know, Amaravati is a highly regarded place and well supported and so forth. I mean, it is not just, you know, living isolated from the world. People that are interested come and try it out and so forth. So that the form of monastic life, I think, as you access this and develop this awareness, so it connects, it has a continuity, a flow of being present in, you know, through the movements of your body, through the morning, you know, the morning puja, through, you know, through the day and night, sleeping even, resting. The whole reality of one's existence is included in awareness. It's not just, you know, 3 months winter's retreat, formal practices, and sitting in the temple, even though this is part of our lifestyle, isn't it? This is part of the lifestyle of a samana, as we regard it here. So we have 3 months winter's retreat, and we have morning, evening pujas, and we encourage meditation, sitting meditation, and so forth, walking, jonggrom, and that. So this is part of a lifestyle, part of the way we live. But it's no longer seen from I have to do it position, a kind of compulsion a compulsive attitude towards practice, because practice isn't something you do, it's a natural flow that one is in, naturally in the moment. So then these restless feelings, as you recognize them, they fade out. Part of it is a restless realm in the body, one's body, or there's the sense impingement. You know, it hits you and it startles, and it, you know, you feel, you know, stimulated or whatever by this, and you feel the cold, or you feel the wind, or the momentum of habits, of just a lifetime of you know, feeling you have, there's something you've got to do. You know, from my background, I was brought up to there's always something to do. You should be doing something. And there was always a lot of guilt I'd experienced about when I wasn't involved in doing something worthwhile. Like I've told you about this recurring dream I used to have when I first went to stay with Ajahn Chah, where I I kept having this dream, and it would be I was going into a coffee shop. And I'd sit down at a table and order some coffee, and then this voice would say, "You shouldn't be here. You've got an examination. You should be studying for your exam." And of course, you know, I kind of had almost a breakdown in graduate school. I was studying so hard. It took me 6 months to recover after I received my MA. I couldn't read for about 6 months because I just, you know, I just crammed and studied this compulsive tendency to have to learn all these things to pass the exam, to prove myself. Pass the exam was absolutely necessary for any kind of self-respect. So then this dream was a, you know, you shouldn't be enjoying just sitting in a cafe drinking a cup of coffee because you've got an exam to take and you should be studying. You're wasting your time. So then I kept thinking, well, you know, here I am, I was at Wat Rapong, I was very sincere, very inspired, you know, and I was trying to learn all the Vinaya rules and do everything right and fit in and learn Thai and do it all properly and meditate, sit and do walking practice and do it all, you know. So I thought I was really working hard at it, trying my best. But this dream kept saying, you know, you shouldn't, you know, any moment of just kind of relaxed enjoyment, this voice would say, you shouldn't be enjoying this, you've got an exam, there's something, you know, you're not prepared for. And when it comes, you know, you won't be ready for it and you'll fail. So anyway, this, I kept thinking maybe I should meditate more. Well, there's something I should do more of that I haven't been doing, and then I couldn't see how I could do any more. I was becoming compulsive about monastic life. So, and I kept recurring, I kept having it over and over, and then suddenly, one time I had this dream, and I woke up, and I understood what it was telling me. And what it really was saying was, there isn't any exam. You've lived your life always as if there was an exam, some great test that you, in the future, that you have to be prepared for. And so any kind of relaxation was, you were wasting your time. You might, you could use this time for serious practice, for study. So I know that in my life, it wasn't that I just studied all the time, but I did find myself, especially in university, oftentimes feeling very guilty about, relaxing too much or enjoying things, because there's always this inner voice saying, you've got an exam and you're not ready. You've got to be ready for it. And then because of this reflective ability, rather than taking this dream literally, began to see that was a mistake. That I'd lived my life always with this perception of there's a big test waiting for you that you're not ready for. That is an illusion. That was a kind of habit tendency that I'd acquired. And so I didn't know how to relax or enjoy anything very much. Because there is always this compulsive feeling of wasting my time. So that once I realized that there wasn't an exam, I never had the dream again. It's like it kept kind of prodding me, jabbing me in the ribs till I recognized what it actually meant. Now the ego is one that operates from that. My personality is, if I fall into personal habits, I go immediately into compulsion and guilt. It's just the way that's conditioned. It's just the way that my personality is a conditioned thing. It operates like that. But awareness is aware, aware the personality arises and ceases. It's not, it has no continuity to it. My personality changes according to the conditions. So, it's just the way it is. It's not that, there's not such a thing as a permanent personality. Just notice in yourself how your personality will change when you're with your parents or with your best friend or at the office or at the monastery or whatever, personal, when you're under pressure or when you're on a holiday, the personality adapts itself to the contingencies. But that which is aware is not personal, and it's not mine. I can't claim it as some kind of personal quality. Because to do that, I have to think. I am a very mindful monk, and that makes no sense. It's like it doesn't mean anything to think that, because the awareness is the ground, the background, the unconditioned gate to the deathless. That's where we begin. That's where we find liberation. So I want to encourage you during this retreat to investigate. Now this takes, investigation, experiment with yourself to question, observe, and witness. And whatever it is, whatever you're feeling, and a lot of negative states or boring states, dullness, doubt, and things like this. They're all part of it. These are conditions that arise and cease. So nothing is like a waste of time or, you know, a real obstruction unless you grasp it. So grasping is the, this clinging, upadana, is the cause. Out of ignorance we grasp conditioned phenomena, and then we're caught once that grasping is seen, and that can only be seen through awareness, recognized, and through awareness we realize non-grasping is liberation. So I offer this as a reflection.